on any level, which you've never had happen in a life before. All those kinds of things. And also just being a woman in New York who ran away from home at 14 and put herself through nursing college by being a dominatrix and also got involved in experimental theatre and performance. So she was, although she was so much younger than me in years, actually far more sophisticated. So to me the mystery was, how did she become so incredible so fast, and how fantastic to finally be proven right in my fantasy from childhood that there has to be someone else in this world, on this planet, that can feel the same way and be the same way and reflect in a sort of positive way, not in a sort of consuming way, but actually reflect so that things just spiral more and more powerfully upwards into something beyond imagination.
There's a chemical concept of miscibility, how much two things can mix, and the sort of compounds that are produced, and the gas and energy and all the other things that are produced is something that I thought of when I looked at this too. And Marie, when I spoke to her about the making of the film, she said sometimes just the energy of the intimacy was so strong, she had to go away.
Yeah. Well, we used to have a little saying, as we still do, see a cliff, jump off. When in doubt, be extreme. And so we were trying to taunt each other to always push, push, and we still are. As far as we're concerned, we'd already decided this project would go on beyond physical bodily existence. That's one of the reasons she would always say the body's a cheap suitcase that just carries around the mind for a while and then throw it away. And so we've always intended to, if it's at all possible, reconvene in another place outside time and space, one might say another dimension. Maybe another world, another galaxy where one continues with the adventures, but we've never ever believed there was an end in sight, and there shouldn't be an end in sight. There should always be more, and it should always be challenging and amazing and shared.
What else did I want to ask?
Sense some amazing things.
When I was a teenager, I heard a lot of music that shocked or seduced people into freedom, as teenagers like to do. So when I heard Throbbing Gristle, what I got from it, DRA was the big album that really affected me in my life. Was that 1976?
78 that it came out.
Yeah, 78. And I realised at the time that in order to do that, there had to be an element of taking people with you as well as going bah! In their face. And we knew that anything could be music and that there was a fabulous musical sublime in the mundanity of everyday sound from John Cage. We had all of that. And what I got from Throbbing Gristle was not the possibilities of what music could be and do, but of song and the form of song and what could be considered a song. And
thank you. You're the first person who realised it. I've been waiting for somebody to tell me that for about 35
And so, I looked at Throbbing Gristle, which had a really big, big impact. I mean, there was the Ramones, and there was Throbbing Gristle, and there was the first Suicide album. These are things that changed my life as a teenage musician. And,
good.
I see it as part of something that includes ABBA and that includes January by Pilot.
Yes.
sick and tired, you've been hanging on me. Yeah.
Cozy was a stripper for a while, and they used to strip to songs like that. So. I had a weird you know, memory of pop music. I see removed bras and cheeks everywhere when I hear all that.
So I'm glad that you said that you've been waiting to hear that, because that's so you were aware of that, and that's what something that you're trying to do there.
Yeah, obviously a big breakthrough. There were, to me, Josh is sounding awfully egocentric, but there were only one, two, maybe three breakthroughs with lyrics and the structures of songs. Bob Dylan was a huge sort of shift in the possibility of the lyric in the song and its function, what it could talk about. And he took it from strict politics to surreal nonsense, where you made up your own meanings. Mm-hmm. And then, for me anyway, the next thing really was Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. And we thought to those came around the same time for me. And Lou Reed took the lyric to the street into sort of a filmic, a movie-like description of things that were really going on. People that were considered outcasts that were included by him in the sort of possibilities of song. And then it just dawned on me that there should be no limits at all on what could be the subject of a song. Mm-hmm. That in fact, just as we said, why learn three chords, when Pump said we should learn three chords and form a band, why should a song have any limitations? The imagination should never, ever have a fence built around it, should never, ever have an ending. And so, deliberately, we saw it with all the lyrics that we wrote, that it was really important to report back on the experience of life, both beautiful and awful. Of course, we got labelled with always talking about the awful, but in fact, if you look at the ratio of songs, there's maybe a handful that are dealing with atrocities. And there's lots of love songs, and there's lots of hilarious, silly songs, like What a Day. What a Day was, we were in the marketplace with the dog, and these old ladies were at the bus stop when they were going to each other. Oh, what a day! What a day! Oh, what a awful day! And then everyone going, yeah, what a day! Oh, what a day! Yeah! Oh, what a day! And that was the song. And it's one of my favourite TG songs. And it's just lifted off the street like that, you know. But it becomes something else when it's recontextualised. And that's always fascinated me. Where there's a way that you see something. And it's that moment between being asleep and awake, when you dream or you think you've thought of something amazing but you can't quite wake up. And the moment, when are you dead? When is the body dead? When is the mind dead? All those sort of lines that we take for granted in day-to-day conversation, but none of them are fixed. We don't know where it begins and ends. We don't know where things meet. And of course now science agrees with particle theory that the gaps between the particles that make up bigger particles are equal to distances of hundreds of miles. So the universe is almost completely empty.
Yeah. And so there's this kind of...
if you can understand the relevance, yeah. That's something that we apply to the lyric in the song.
Yeah. And there is in that also this play of the dissolving of limits. The limit is really continual theme of the work, all the way through from the very beginning, bashing your head up again. Limits and just dissolving through limits.
And you write about the strategies. Now, with TG, ended in 81. And it mainly ended for me, we were the first person to say, you know, we've got to stop. And the others went, you know what, yeah. And it was because it had become too easy. It had almost become a formula that was being iterated by industrial music as it spread. And of course that's not challenging. And when we made the first Psychic TV album, the first song we finished was Just Drifting. And that had an orchestra and was based on my interpretation of Frank Sinatra doing a ballad, Leave It or Not. And we cried with laughter in the studio, thinking, the TG fans are going to hate this. That's great. And times change, you know, the punk thing, the industrial thing, all those different actions were because of the way that the world was at the time. England was falling apart with a three-day week and Thatcher and Reagan, all that mess. But then, if you are fortunate enough to get people's attention, there comes a point where you have to reconsider how to communicate. And that demands respect of the people you're speaking to. It becomes, you get a responsibility. And it's no longer just the yelling and shouting. Suddenly, you have a duty to try to be as honest as you can to the people that are listening, and to try to keep explaining what you're perceiving and why you're seeing it that way, and why things are dissolving the way they are in terms of what you think of reality. And so, PTV has always been an ongoing, amorphic vehicle for us to have a dialogue with society at any given time.
And so there's this, there is less of a sense in PTV of being overtly challenging, revolutionary on a broad scale. So you look back at Throbbing Gristle and you say, this was a revolutionary sound, this really changed stuff. You look at the idea of cutting your body, challenging the boundaries that exist between two people. It's a, there's a violence in both of these things that is an element of shock, of and it looks like a deliberate attempt to challenge, to break through, do that stuff. That is not as overt when you listen to PTV.
And it's not meant to be. And when you watch the film, hopefully you see, as you did see, you see love. And it's funny, the last thing that we were obviously friends with Burroughs and Geisen for a long time. It was Burroughs that set me on my course in a way when he said, how do you short-circuit control? And he was a man who was actually privately very tormented by his personal life, that he'd abandoned his own son, Billy Jr., who eventually died about 40 years old after a liver transplant, who'd been a speed freak, and tried to emulate his father in order to get his attention. And Uncle Bill, as we used to call him, Burroughs, shot his own wife, Joan, in the head in this tragedy in Mexico. And we were speaking to him a lot at that time on the phone. He was in Naropa in Colorado. And he was crying when he realized that Billy had died, because he'd never been forgiven, and he'd never asked for forgiveness. But then, after he died, James Grauholtz, his partner and friend, came to New York and rang me up to go and see him. And he told me about William dying, and then he showed me William's diary. And the very last entry said, I have just realized, it might not be exactly word perfect, but I've just realized that all there is to life is love. And the pen actually trails off like that, as if he died when he said it. And I started to cry, and I said, thank God he found that out before he died. It was that close.
It's the most precious bit of knowledge I have in my life, for sure.
And it's something when we decided to be a creator of art and music, literature, whatever, we thought we will never sacrifice those we love to making art. Those we love should always come first, no matter what. And that was a really strong and important difference, in a way, in our approach.
So, we've got a few minutes. If you want to have a clap, have a clap. Something very nice about the voice. Putting two hands together and making that sound to each other. But there's a man here who's had his hand up. Would you like to say something?
Not wanting to love the past, I'm just wondering what's going to happen to your archive.
It's already gone, actually. This is one of the great ironies of life. As some people here will know, in 1992, the British government raided my house in Brighton and took away 2 tons of the archives, all the films, all the videos, every photograph. Sometimes the only copies of movies by Derek Jarman and myself, of William and Brian, and destroyed everything. They never charged me even with a parking ticket, but we weren't allowed back in Britain for 7 years. Why? They hated the artworks we were making and what we were saying. But here's the great irony. Last, the year before last, the Tate Britain purchased the remaining archive. And last summer, they actually exhibited, and it said in the programme, elements of the archives of Genesis Brian Peerage, one of the modern masters of British art. But even more ridiculous was that when the whole explosion of scandal happened in 1976 with the prostitution show, and they kept freaking out because I'd made these silly sculptures with used tampons. And to explain how silly, for example, one was an Art Deco clock filled with used tampons, and it was called "It's That Time of the Month." Kind of schoolboy humour, right? But they called me a wrecker of civilization for that.
Ooh.
It's pretty close to carry.
Dirty boy.
And yeah, that is British audio. But when they bought the archives, the Tate Britain actually got in touch and they said, "We do get the tampons, don't we?" And we said, "Of course you do."
So, is there any more questions?
This might be a complex question because I've got rather a personal interest in your recent work, because I did some data experiments myself with a similar goal in a way, and they're kind of opposite. In 2000, I took estrogen for 9 months as a magical process, and I took estrogen for 9 months in 2000 as a deliberate magical process, and at the end of it, married myself. So it was kind of like one becoming two, whereas it's like you were like more like two becoming one. Although for me it was like one becoming two becoming one again, so it kind of came back around being the same thing in a way. But what I'm curious about is how much when you started the project you were thinking about hermaphroditism, because it was like my intention with taking the estrogen seemed different because other people I knew who'd taken it were like trying to change genders, whereas I wanted to become as much a woman as I could without becoming any less a man. And it seemed like a whole different process that was challenging to other transgender people. And so I'm kind of curious whether you and Lady J started out with an intention of both becoming hermaphroditic, something in between each other, or whether you were becoming each other as in you're becoming female and her becoming male, and how much of that process was involved.
Well, first of all, it seems like your emphasis is very much about the physical and the biological.
Well, no, whereas that was just a result of earlier experiments, but yeah.
Well, just the way that you phrased it.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be a criticism.
Yeah.
It's meant to be a way of splitting the answer.
Yeah.
For us, we always thought that we wanted to merge to become literally one being, which is why we always knew it had to be after physical death. So our entire intention has always been for us personally to reconvene after physical death and then actually surrender to each other and become literally one consciousness, wherever and however that might be. Having said that, yes, of course, being the people we are, we wanted to have more of everything. And so our feeling was, why have only a vagina or a penis? Surely it's better to have both. And so if we could have, and we did ask doctors about this, is there a way to construct in some form both genitals? And they said, not yet, which was a shame. In the end, it doesn't really matter to us, because what we're doing is most important in the way that we symbolize an idea. We did do an estrogen and testosterone experiment together, Jake taking testosterone and me taking estrogen. And my God, I realized what a terrible time women get sometimes. I kept crying. I was a bitch. Jay said to me, and he said, oh, for God's sake, stop taking those pills. I can't stand it. Meanwhile, she was kind of, whoa, shut up. It was really bad news. So we now have a much deeper empathy for the hormonal tricks of nature. But it was never about gender. That's something that we, but that's one reason we picked a word, androgyny. Positive androgyny, which to us is basically the divine hermaphrodite. And if you're trying to reach a place that's beyond human, if you're talking about ultimate evolution and the return to something divine and amazing and pure, which in Buddhism would be to never reincarnate anymore, to become just love, as we understand it, then our whole point was that you can actually still play with identity. And then we got interested in the social aspect of that. In order for human beings to change, they have to change the way they behave. And behavior is contained in our DNA and in our story, going back to the most early primitive times. And it's a long explanation that we can't do tonight, but basically we came to the conclusion that what we were really saying all along wasn't anything to do even with just gender and identity. It was saying the human species is an unfinished project. This isn't a sacred body, this is just a body, something that makes the mind portable, as Timothy Leary used to say too. And if we're going to try and think about how we explore the universes that are out there, then we have to actually just completely let go of thinking the body is finished or sacred or in any way meant to stay the way it is. So we began to dream and think about to travel into space and colonize space like Geising would have liked, and Burroughs and Leary. Then wouldn't it be good to become cold-blooded? Then you wouldn't need to heat the craft, and maybe you'd learn to hibernate, maybe have fur, but if you're going to be weightless, why have legs? Have four arms instead. And so on. And suddenly to let go of any preconception at all of what the body can be. And then just begin to think, what could happen? What could I imagine? And there's no reason that we cannot be anything at all, except the limitation of imagination and the fact that people think in terms of bits of the human species, nations, families, tribes, belief systems. We visualize the human species as one organism of which each of us are just a tiny cell. And if we all think of our species as one organism, we would naturally assign the resources we have to the place that they would do the most good, because that would be the most healthy way of maintaining the organism. It's obvious. When you look at that and think about the way that the people who govern us work, you can see where the big tragedy comes. And part of that is the either-or syndrome. We're an American. You're an Egyptian. I'm a Catholic. You're a Buddhist. You're black. I'm white. You're a man. You're a woman. All of that is utilized to create fear so that we don't realize the opportunities we have. And we don't apply all the resources we have and the amazing ability to invent and build tools and possibilities. And if we all just use those for the species, we would be the most amazing creatures in the universe. And all of us would have a much, much more exciting time.
But at the same time... very, very active, but there is a principle of a kind of active surrender in what you talk about a lot, by just giving over to a letting happen, the principle of the car, of letting it just happen in a kind of active way.
Gotta love that laugh.
It seems to me to be, because you've said about love. Love is a surrender, a giving over to it. Right? It's there's a decision in there as well. So rather than contradictory, it's like complementary, the surrender and the action.
Well, we didn't expect our surrender to each other to end up implying, you know, considering the evolution of the species. You know, then, but then there we were, and we were thinking it was Burroughs that led us there. Because we thought, well, where is the story, the recording that we are submitting to when we're born is DNA. That's a recording that goes back to the slime mold. And so the whole story of humanity is written in the DNA. So DNA is critical in the battle for true freedom to choose. And that was one reason we wanted to deny being one or the other gender, and came up with a word that didn't, at least then, have any baggage.
Well, Peter's giving me signs. I think that it's time to stop.
Do one more question?
Yeah.
Is there
one more?
No, that's good.
Should we have one more? Do I have another
question? There's one right up there.
Where?
Oh, it's somebody very tall, I can't tell.
Ask a question.
I guess nobody has anything to say.
I think I've got to hear something here.
Yeah. We prefer the more intensely human phrase that you used. Definitely, yeah. There's funny little things that we noticed when we started to merge with each other and reflect each other. And one of them was that when a fetus is fertilized, you basically see the story so far. First of all, it's a single cell, and then it splits into many cells, and then it becomes a tiny little lizard, and then it's an amphibian, and then it becomes a monkey, and then it becomes a strange little creature that comes out of a vulva. And that's just incredible in itself, that the story so far is written down in gestation. And that seems significant. And also we thought, what about thinking of it this way? There's the sperm and the egg, and they meet. But instead of them eventually becoming a cluster, they meet and they just become one larger being. And then again, one larger. So although that's an abstract way of thinking, that's kind of what we're talking about, is this much more all-enfolding, inclusive way of seeing existence and trying to think of positive ways to utilize the skills and the amazing abilities that we all have. We call that the genius factor. That every single human being has a genius factor of some kind. And that can be brought out and can become a contribution to the final revelation of the wonders that we are.
Well, I think that's a really good note to end on. I'd like to thank Genesis for talking to us today. I'd like to thank you for your work, for your lifetime of work, and for the movie and everything, and that everybody could join me. To make this happen, it's a kind of a rare opportunity that was not meant to happen, that the Adelaide Festival tried to deliberately not allow to happen anywhere else in Australia. So I was seeking for a moment. Thanks again to Geeta for organising this and the whole thing. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.